work session on House Bill 2217 and House Bill 3016. Possible work session on House Bill 2176, House Bill 2438, House Bill 2463, House Bill 2606, House Bill 2764, and House Bill 2775.
House members wish to come to order. The clerk will note those members present. The balance are excused. First item on the agenda for work session is House Bill 2217.
Okay, the committee wanted to see this bill in a redrafted form. No decisions have been made, except that it should be redrafted.
While Joan's passing that, it'd be my intention, since we've worked pretty hard this week, if we can get through two or three of the bigger bills and dispose them one way or the other, to call an early adjournment, allow the committee members to go out and frolic in the sun or whatever else.
How about staff?
Touches their fancy. Staff, too.
Thank you.
Okay, you want to run us through the...
Yes, this is the bill that would prohibit probation for certain people. Okay, the condition, the probation would be prohibited for a person who has been previously convicted of two or more felonies which were not part of the same criminal episode. That was a concern. And the person had within 3 years either been convicted of one of those felonies or the person had been in prison during those 3 years for a felony, because if the person were in prison for those 3 years and then came out for part of those 3 years and then came out and did a felony, he would be what the witnesses were calling a hot criminal. So that's subsections A and B. Paragraph A and B, excuse me. Subsection 2 was put in because there was no procedure in the original bill for how this was to be brought to the attention of the judge. So I copied this from a bill from last session as the procedure. Judges haven't seen this. I would assume that the judge's opposition would remain the same to this bill as was to the original bill, which is, takes away all their discretion. Then we have definition of previously been convicted of a felony. The previous offense was a felony under Oregon law. But for purposes of the sentencing, it won't be deemed a conviction of a felony if it was made a misdemeanor by the type of sentence imposed, if it was for possession of marijuana, or if it was 20 years prior to the conviction. Then Section 3 has an extra ORS in it. Section 3 is the part that says that under the Community Corrections Act, notwithstanding the Community Corrections Act, the county won't have to pay a charge for sentencing somebody under this bill.
Okay. And that's it, John?
Yep.
That's it. It's in technical good shape. I leave the policy to you.
What do you see the policy as being, John? The policy decision?
I suppose really whether the extent to which you want to change the traditional function of the judge in sentencing.
Well, isn't it more than that, though? I mean, are we talking about the conflict potential of the matrix system?
Well, of course, we don't know what kind of sentencing guidelines the judicial conference will come up with. In the second proposed draft of the bill that Mr. Haas submitted, parole would have been prohibited also. That's been taken out. So theoretically, I suppose the person would come in under the matrix system once he's sentenced.
What's our fiscal impact on this, John?
Confused. Okay, we have this letter from Mr. Haas. He doesn't get... No, that was no parole.
Does the judicial conference have a position on this?
They oppose it. They don't want to be told how to sentence people. The letter from Mr. Haas indicates that there would be potentially 63 people sentenced in a biennium under the bill. The original Corrections Division estimate was 210. That was as the bill was introduced, which didn't have restrictions, the restrictions contained in the current version of the bill. The Corrections Division, not having seen the current version, hasn't given any estimate.
Talking about 21 defendants a year, and I think Representative Richards proposed to us a per day dollar figure of $22 a day for incarceration. Anybody remember that?
21.
Well, 21.
I think Representative Dugas said 12,000 a year.
Well, anyway, using those figures, I get a fiscal impact about 168,000 a year.
Using 21 is only Multnomah County.
Okay, you're right. You're right. That's for Multnomah County. That's what Delta gives us about 300,000.
Also, the Corrections Division says that they're already overcrowded. I don't know what effect that has on the fiscal impact. I can't imagine they would start building a prison for career criminals. I suppose there comes a point at which overcrowding has a negative has a fiscal impact.
Well, let's at least get the show on the road and see what we're going to do with this. Sure, I'd move adoption of proposed amendments titled Proposed Redraft, House Bill 2217, April 17, 1979. Is there a discussion?
It should be amended, Mr. Chairman. Line 27, that first ORF should be.
Right.
I assume we'll amend
the
rate.
Yeah, we're going to work on this once we adopt it.
I have no objection to this. It's a working paper.
Is there further discussion of the chair's motion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Would you restate the motion, please?
I don't have to call the roll. The motion is to adopt this as a working point to amend from, to dispose of this one way or the other. Is there objection to the motion? Okay, if not, it's adopted. Okay, there are further amendments to House Bill 2217.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Line 26, starting with a new subparagraph for ND, I would ask that included under these provisions, which shall not be considered felonies for the purpose of the proposed bill, those statutory provisions relating to a felony driving while suspended.
Okay, Representative Mason's moved after subsection C of subsection 3 on page 1 of the bill, a new sub D be added, which would include as not to be considered as felonies for purposes of this act, felony driving while suspended charges. Is there a discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Tom, what do you propose to do for the guy that's a three-time loser on driving while suspended? Isn't it about time that he gets a term in state penitentiary?
I'm worried about the individual that's a two-time loser on driving while suspended then somehow gets himself into a Class C felony situation on something else where it takes away a lot of, I think, perhaps necessary flexibility in a new situation.
Just as a comment, my experience, I have never seen someone sent to the penitentiary for
felony DWI. I think Judge Beatty told us the other day, or someone did, that it has happened. At least the inference was that jail time is being given.
Well, I've seen it a year in
the penitentiary.
I've seen a year in the county jail many times. but I've never seen anyone sent to the penitentiary for felony defense.
Well, it just seems to me that that removes the teeth from the DWS statute in case someone wants to do it, and that maybe we could make a friendly amendment that if it's a single DWS felony charge that puts the person into jeopardy, that could be excluded. But if it is the person's third shot at a DWS dog pound, I think you got to go down there.
Well, there's nothing, Representative Smith, in this bill that would prohibit a judge, even on the first felony DWS, from sending someone to the penitentiary. All we're saying is that as a matter of policy, that we are not going to take away the judge's discretion not to send someone to the penitentiary on the third felony DWS or a combination of felonies, one of which would be a felony DWS if the amendment's adopted.
I'm not sure I followed all that.
Well,
answer me this. If a person were convicted on a third DWS,
right,
would the exception that Representative Mason has proposed cause the judge to be limited in any way from sending that person to penitentiary?
No, absolutely not. He just would not have the discretion not to send him. See, there's nothing here that says that even on the first felony that a judge can't send someone to the penitentiary. All we're saying is on the third felony in certain situations that the person must go.
And we would, I guess on this vote, be saying that we do not want a person to have to go to the penitentiary for three consecutive DWS charges.
In all cases. Okay. You've heard the motion. Is there further discussion on the motion? Is there a chairman? Person from Martin?
No, I'm sharing with the motion. The motion is to adopt
the motion. The motion is to add a new subsection D in subsection 3 of page 1, which would provide that felony DWSs are not to be considered felonies for the purposes of this act. Is there further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Rutherford? Representative Richard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Frommeyer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Dugas?
Aye.
Representative
Gardner? Aye. Representative Rutherford, would you like to be?
Aye.
He's an aye. Carries. Further amendments to the bill?
Chairman?
Representative Frommeyer?
Can I ask Mr. Smith the Attorney General's office a question?
Certainly. Mr. Smith, would you like to come on?
Allison, does either the District Attorney's Association or the Attorney General's office or both have a position on this bill as rewritten?
Yes, for the record, I'm Allison Smith, representing the District Attorneys Association, but not today, the Attorney General. The District Attorneys Association 2 days ago took position that they were in favor of this bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there further discussion of bills amended? Representative Rutherford.
If we're discussing the bill, I wonder, Joan, I have this vague recollection that we used to have a habitual criminal statute in Oregon and was declared unconstitutional. Do you you know of that? Do you know why that was done? Does it have any relationship to this sort of a statute? It's probably 10 years ago. It seems to me it was ruled unconstitutional.
I don't know. To find out, although not.
To the extent I could comment on at least half your question, to the extent that we have the ability to impose mandatory minimum sentences for any felonies or any crime, we have the ability to do what's done in the statute. So I don't think there's a constitutional argument that can be made against the statute to say that in a certain case, a certain felony with other conditions present, the judge does not have the discretion to grant probation.
Well, I remember these statutes were quite popular around the United States. You got, if you were a three-time loser, was the saying, you went to jail and there was just no questions asked. And that's basically what this is, does.
I think there was an added penalty of a certain number of years after so many offenses in addition to the sentence that you received in the third or following offense.
Well, I don't know. It just strikes me that cases are similar enough that I just wondered if there wasn't some reason to take a look at that.
That's something for us to research, I guess, John.
Yeah.
I think we still have technical problems.
The further session, the bill is amended.
Chairman, I would only say after the last session, I went back and checked with some of my local people, and granted, I have not heard from my local DAs, but I have heard from my local judges. Seemingly, they don't feel it's necessary. They don't let anybody out on the third time anyway.
Is there further amendments, further motions on the bill? Well, Representative Rutherford, do you want to have the bill set over?
I think that'd be a good idea to have it set over and explain out the answer to the question. I may be way off base, but I have this question in my mind. And I wouldn't be prepared to vote for the bill.
The bill will be carried over for about a week so that we can have an opportunity to check out any conflict that there might be as far as constitutional problem and prior habitual offender statute.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dugas.
Let's discuss that for a minute, if you don't mind. I'm a little surprised. This the first time I've heard of the question of constitutionality. We've been getting stiffer sentence type legislation last session, contemplating other bills this session. Am I missing something here? I think it's an up or down deal.
Well, Representative Rutherford has some concern, and it's been the policy of the chair to try to at least put the members in the committee in a position where they felt comfortable in voting on the measure, had an opportunity to satisfy their concerns. And since this is the first time this has been raised, would be the chair's desire at this point to carry the matter over.
If the committee wants to move it out, they can take a shot at the bill. I'd have to be able to know vote to
I have no idea whether it'll move out. I just thought we'd dispose of it one way or the other. That was my thought of it.
If there's a motion on the bill, I'll be glad to accept it.
Would that offend you?
Choose no. I vote no today.
I move the bill as the floor with the due passes amendment.
Representative Dugas moves that House Bill 2217 is amended to be sent to the floor. I guess we want to put it in the gross since we put it in the gross with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Is it the floor?
It's to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Richard?
No.
Mason?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Somar?
Aye.
Cohen?
No.
Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye. Fails. Well, I guess since Representative Rutherford has a concern, since it's 5-4, perhaps we'll set this matter over for one more week.
All right, you go.
Okay, we'll now take up House Bill
2438. I'll be working with this version of the bill, although it's never been officially adopted. Is that
one of the green tracks that's
on the green tracks? Mine's probably on the green
tracks. Yeah, what is the
number on? House Bill 2438, LC number 2627.
I don't have a copy.
I don't have a copy.
I'll share with President Stone.
Okay.
He just read through the amendments that we made last time and where we're at. And
okay. The the reason that the bill was carried over was that not everyone was here last time. And the specific things that still need to be discussed or need to be discussed again are, to begin with, the definition of mentally ill, including medical needs. I have concerns that a court would find that unconstitutional to declare a person mentally ill and have him civilly committed solely on the basis that he needs treatment. And I pointed out a couple of cases to the committee that don't decide the issue but do raise it. So that's the first issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Christian Smith.
Well, I know last time we read at least the pertinent portions of those cases. And I'm looking at the definition. A mentally ill person means a person who, because of mental disorder, that has to be found first, is prevented from or substantially impaired in the ability to control personal conduct such that the person is either dangerous to self or unable to provide for basic needs, including medical. And it seems to me that it's not just a one-shot deal. Medical is sort of being focused on here, I get the feeling, and if you have to go through these other findings first before medical, which is just one of a person's basic needs. We are setting the policy. Medical needs are basic needs.
I have a philosophical argument, which I want to talk about, but I...
We'll talk about it.
It doesn't apply, sorry. It's a field, it's a stray, pertinent issue.
Okay.
The reason that medical is being focused on is because that's the new part of the definition.
Right.
And because Representative Zajon, as an example, said that a person would be committed under this definition who is manic depressive and refuses to take lithium. The finding presumably would be that a mental disorder is preventing him from taking lithium, there being no other explanation for the fact that he's not doing it.
Well, it seems to me that they have to make a finding. I say that the judge has to make a finding that individual is not able to provide for own basic needs. And that one of the things he's allowed as a judge to look at is medical needs as being basic. If you can't feed yourself, if you, you're immobile, any of these things would be a potential.
The real problem, I guess, is I see some people in the district, and if you're going to talk about basic medical needs, which are not provided for in this country, and then you use that as one of the criteria that you're going to institutionalize somebody, I find that really hard to do.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
I signed on to this bill early because I thought there was a need for some philosophical change in the way that we're approaching this, and I find myself also falling back into this sort of a syndrome that we're going to do something to somebody, and I'm trying to even keep my own mental thoughts on we're going to try to help somebody.
One further discussion.
Representative Cohen.
I guess I don't have confidence that the medical profession knows exactly well enough to know that, in fact, when you have a definition that says that they need treatment and then you ship them off to have treatment, that in fact the cure is, you know, that's forthcoming necessarily, and that I guess I don't see it as necessarily all that much progress.
Well, if I can carry on this colloquy, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Would it not be the judge's prerogative to make the decision on whether the judge is confident rather than whether Representative Cohen or Representative Smith would be confident? I mean, what we're devising is a system, and if a judge is given satisfactory evidence, either by experts or however it comes in under this bill, then the judge has to decide whether the treatment is worse than the cure or vice versa.
Mr. Chair.
Represent. That's fine.
Okay, do you mind?
I'm the swing vote probably here, okay. And I haven't made up my mind yet, so I am listening to this, and okay. I wasn't here for the prior discussion, so Representative Cohen.
Okay, the real concern that I have, and I'm not doing it because I have some of my best friends are psychiatrists, I think that. The question is, the decision about what the judge is going to be ruling on is developed by the same people, in a sense, of those that we're assuming to do the treatment. So that's where you run into the problem. And the fact is that the same criteria are you...
Same
closed
system.
Yeah, that's my real concern about it.
Well, for the chair's benefit, if I may only add that I took Representative Zajonc's testimony before the committee and in work session to be that this was a very key component to the bill, and if we are trying to advance the state of the art at all, I'd like to see it go to the floor with that in it. It may get thrown back in our faces here, but unless it's a totally repugnant policy, I think this is one of those areas where we need to see if it's going to go or not.
Representative Frohmeyer.
I'd like to call to the committee's attention the amendments drafted by Judge Bates, which were just distributed, and which represent compromise and improved language, with which Representative Zajon, now in front of this, she agrees, at least with respect to the definition of mentally ill person. We'll find that following the amendments. Memorandum, the last two pages of it. Maybe it's a way of getting it off center, Mr. Chairman, so I would move the adoption of proposed amendments supplied by Judge Bating, dated April 6, 1979, with respect to the definition of mentally ill person.
Point of clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Are we working with the language as in the draft here, or are we working with present language? I think we're working with language as in the draft. Isn't that right, Representative Rutherford? You were.
That's what we did all last session.
The whole language is in the bill, Tom. The whole language is underlined. You've got the whole thing
okay.
here.
Okay. So we're working with. If we don't, adopt these amendments, we go with the new language in this bill.
Yeah. Well, that's a question.
So that's the question.
The question, I wasn't here, I could normally answer that, but I wasn't here when we had the work session on this bill. Did we adopt these as the amendments?
No, it was only being used as the working draft.
Yeah, we were working piece by piece.
Piece by piece from this, though, because what it does really basically is incorporate two different bills.
Okay,
but I would also say, Mr. Chairman, there was an error. There was a significant mistake in the manner of drafting those amendments. In that all this material following the word needs period on line 16 should not be underlined. See, it's an interesting, it's existing language in the law. It's been carried out to modify needs.
Mr. Chairman, it's unduly complicated because of the reason that Representative Bugis points out. It boiled down, the policy question is whether or not you're going to include the words including medical needs, and we voted last time not to include those words, the effect of which was to retain the present statute.
With, I think,
okay.
one or two members absent.
Yes.
That's okay. Correct. Well, let's adopt the working draft. First, let's start.
You're talking about the one that's dated 3/16/79.
Right.
Well, in some respects, we did adopt it later on. We went through it change by change.
Right.
That part we did not adopt. We voted on it with less than a full committee and did not adopt it. You may wish to renew the question and vote on it again, or you may wish to consider the amendments that Representative Frohmeyer has moved.
Well. Okay, do you want to, your motion, Representative Frohmeyer, is to amend the bill with these amendments?
Yeah, or
okay.
It could be this draft, it's going to be the same thing.
Okay.
I move substitute the definition of mentally ill person as it's found in the first full paragraph on this proposed amendment.
Okay, Representative Frohmeyer has moved that House Bill 2438 be amended by deleting line 711 on page 2 and inserting the following language that appears on the third page of the memorandum from the Judicial Conference dated April 6, 1979, and is found in the first full paragraph of that page, dealing with mentally ill persons. Is there discussion?
Well, I don't think the amendments are correct because they say delete line 7 through 11, and I think what they mean is delete line 7, or line 8 through 17.
Well, yeah, they're working with the original version of the bill. That's okay.
Okay.
Hmm? Oh, they were, right? Okay.
Okay. The motion is correct. It's line 7 through 11 of the original bill. Is there discussion?
Let me just speak to what I see as the difference here and why this might be language that would cause some of those who have this fight about the medical needs issue to accept that, and that is that it isn't just the absence of medical needs, which could be one's the doctor's perception that you need psychiatric care, but goes on to talk about no one else can provide them, and as a direct consequence of that, the person has serious health or safety hazards. So it attaches a criterion by which one measures the seriousness of the lack of the medical need, rather than simply saying we use medical need as a catch-all thing that will allow the doctors to do whatever the hell they want.
Mr. Chairman.
Kristen Mason.
I'll tell you the flaw in this. It's exposed to serious health hazard. I don't think a court on constitutional grounds will find that when they get right down to the bottom line of that phrase, serious health hazard, and you have to read it as serious health or safety hazards. Serious health hazard will serve as a constitutional foundation for commitment. And that's an essential element, and that's what it gets down to, that they're not getting their medical needs, there's no one else provide for them short of detention or commitment, and they're exposed to serious health hazard. Because of the lack of, they're not getting their medical needs, there's no one else to provide, and as a result of that, they're exposed to serious health hazard. I don't think serious health hazard will pass a constitutional muster under cases we discussed before, and that's the question. Maybe somebody else has a different interpretation. I think that's the problem.
Let me respond, Tom. I think in some ways this standard is more restrictive than the one in the existing statute, because the existing statute speaks about necessary for health or safety. It doesn't even say seriousness of it. So in some respects, I think what Judge Beatty has given us is a more restrictive standard with respect to how much one's health and safety must be endangered than exists in the present statute, with which I guess you were reasonably satisfied before. I do differ. I think that accommodates your concern.
I don't share the same concerns or upset Mason does either, because I think you have to accept the health and safety hazard in the context of the ability of the individual to take preventative measures to protect himself from that health or safety hazard. And by the definitions in this provision, we are saying that the individual is incapable of taking preventative measures, taking steps himself to avoid serious health or safety hazards. And so that when you take the thing totally in context of the whole subparagraph, I think you have it just that situation. And you don't. I don't think you can isolate and simply say that we're going to deem a person mentally ill commit him simply because he's exposed to a serious health or safety hazard. You just can't isolate him that way. And that's not the sole ground.
But that, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Percent Mason.
But as you read the amendments, that's the bottom line ground there. That's the final, literally the keystone to it.
Again, it's in context and in conjunction with the inability to do anything about it.
But the inability to do anything about it results in a condition which is going to justify the commitment, condition being you being exposed to a serious health standard.
So,
I
think that is the constitutional justification then for stepping in for purposes of confinement or commitment. To take over for that person so that that person does not go into or lapse into that kind of a detrimental situation or into that lapse into the danger to self situation.
Can I quote?
First and eighth.
Quote Justice Bergen's concurring opinion in the O'Connor versus Donaldson. Darge and I accept the theory that a state may lawfully confine an individual thought to need treatment and justify that deprivation of liberty solely by providing some treatment.
Non-point.
The purpose of the serious health hazard would be logically to provide treatment.
No, not necessarily at all. I mean, hopefully that would occur, but what we're talking about is preventing a person who's out there decompensating from doing self in or from having, you know, being killed by frostbite or hypothermia because running around outside in sub-zero weather without clothes. Or,
well,
I don't see that the quote's on point, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, the phrase reads, is
that what it means?
Is able to provide for his basic personal needs, that's fine, that passes the muster, including medical needs. So if you're unable to provide for your medical needs, you have no one else who can provide them for the same for him in absence of detention, and is for this reason, i.e. the lack of medical needs being provided for that reason, that you're exposed to a serious health standard. If that is indeed the rationale for your commitment, and you are committed, you will be treated. Your medical needs will then be fulfilled. And the fulfilling of medical needs, I would maintain, is treatment, and the courts have said that the necessity of treatment is not sufficient justification.
Let's, you know, I think there's at least an element of truth in what Representative Mason has said, because if you read the present language, basic, and is not able to provide for his own basic needs. That's the present language in the statute. There is a category of people who are not being committed, who apparently are doing well enough in clothing themselves, you know, living perhaps not the best of existences, mm-hmm. who are not taking care of their medical needs because perhaps they could live a better existence if they did. But they aren't being found probably half dead with no clothes on or things like that, because if they were, then they would be sent and committed because they wouldn't be taking care of their basic needs. So medical needs, heretofore, the mere not taking care of one's medical needs has not, as I understand it, been construed to be taking care of one's own basic needs. It's something more than that. It's outside of that. Basic needs.
Well,
at least in some cases.
Chairman, I think it goes beyond that with all due respect, because it is modified by the thing which must be its consequence, and that is that for the reason that one is not receiving medical needs, and for that reason is exposed to serious health and safety hazards. It's not just talking about the group of people who, it's not saying a group of people are in the net as long as they're making it, albeit a little crazily. It's talking about people who are really in trouble. The last half of the sentence is the modifier that makes a difference, much of it.
Well, the present language says is not able to provide for own basic needs and is not receiving such care as is necessary for health and safety. That's the present language that modifies after. So all you're adding to that is, you know, serious hazard, which I guess makes it a little stronger. But, you know, there's a group of people that are apparently going to be picked up like this, and I'm really concerned as to who that group of people is. That's the question. I see it. Well, is there further discussion on the motion? The motion is on by Representative Frohnmeyer to adopt the amendments from the judicial conference on page 3, deleting lines 7 and 11, inserting language relating to mentally ill persons.
I'm going to call the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Call of the committee? I've never heard of that one.
Here.
Well, we vote and see if it makes any difference before we start arresting our members on the streets and highways. Mr. Chairman, why don't we go ahead and vote and see if it makes a difference before we start arresting our members on the streets and highways?
She's coming. We'll wait.
Which of you will explain the motion to us?
Okay, the motion is by Representative Hellmeyer to add the language related to mentally ill persons that's found in the judicial conference. This language right there. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugan?
Aye.
Cohen?
No.
Hellmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Richard?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
No. Passes. Okay. What's the next issue?
Okay. What's the list? The next issue is the investigation report. Page 4. Well, last time the motion was made to adopt that language, underlined language on page 4, and the motion failed, so that language is not adopted. I don't know whether you want to vote on that. Actually, what I was asked to bring up again was the definition and the standard of proof, so I guess the investigation report then is just out.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fromar.
We have another doozy from Judge Beatty here that looks pretty good. Again, a meaningful compromise.
Sometimes I'm wondering who's writing the law, the judiciary or the legislature. Okay.
So they got to interpret it.
Yeah, you got really.
They don't at least know what they meant, I think.
Hopefully.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I suggest just moving this along. This beautiful Friday afternoon, I move adoption of the proposed amendments on page 3 of the original bill or page 4 of the mocked-up bill. The bottom half of this secondary of this the Beatty amendments.
Okay. Representative Fromar moves that on page 3 of the bill, lines 13 through 18 be deleted, and insertion of the second paragraph following the first paragraph that we just voted on relieves mentally ill persons. Is there discussion? Representative Fromar first.
Let me ask first the committee, how many of you received the memorandum from Owen Blank of Tonkin, Tarkin, Gale, and Senator Halleck?
Yes.
A very eloquent and thorough analysis. I disagree with some of the provisions, but I think it's been very thoughtful about it. That is sort of the argument in opposition to making any change. The arguments for making change said it doesn't make any sense to have experts if you deprive experts of those pieces of data which mean they're most relevant for experts rendering any kind of sensible opinion. The opposition to it said that, well, hell, this is too much hearsay packed into the investigative report, and therefore you have questions of reliability and fairness that are involved. And what the Beatty Amendment Superiors have done is to put the difference by saying that you can get it in, but that you can only get in certain pieces of it, or for limited purposes, and that you can test go behind the report by virtue of getting access to the people who actually made the statements or objecting to their being produced on the basis, I guess, of hearsay. So I think it splits the difference in a way that should make it acceptable to both concerns.
Okay, Representative Richards.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, on line 2 of the proposed amendment, I feel real uncomfortable with the language provided as soon as possible prior to the hearing. Does that mean when you show up that morning? It could mean that, in which case, what will be the opportunity to secure the witnesses for rebuttal? In the second place, I think the middle or the second sentence of those amendments broaden the dissemination of the investigative report. Where before in the bill draft, I think we're considering just the examiner's access. Now we're handing it out to everybody involved in the process. And lastly, I guess I feel I just still feel uncomfortable that opportunity to cross-examine everyone is not going to be there. The report will be disseminated, and it still leaves I don't know how to phrase it, but I just feel real uncomfortable.
Representative Cohen.
I like an explanation from Representative Romar, please. Are we, in fact, then opening up the system to the point where if we have an indigent who is eligible to be committed and you get no kind of problem there, who's going to pay? And if the person who is not indigent under any kind of felony thing, but just a poor person who can't hire an attorney to get to come in and question the witnesses and, in a sense, clear the record for you, that comes in on under the 14-day, under these records that come in, whose responsibility is that, and is there going to be any cost involved, and to whom, when we broaden again? One more thing to look at cross-examining and checking out a witness and finding out whether what the neighbor said was really true. I'd like some clarification about that.
Representative Fromar, I think the question is directed to you.
Yeah, I yield to the two raised hands.
Representative Fromar, I think we dealt with that yesterday when we passed on, without recommendation as I recall, the report on attorney's fees to this committee. And that we did provide for indigent defense counsel, if I recall, investigative costs and so forth would be included in that if the court sees fit. My own experience has been in the court-appointed area in this activity, and usually you get a call not too many days ahead of the hearing. It's usually very, very quick notice, because they can only hold someone so long on one of these reports. There is very little time to do investigation, but you do have the option of asking, I think we're 72 hours set over, if I'm correct, to allow for investigation primarily. And in prior circumstances, I was expected to do that if I could track anything down, and really was not provided any resources with which to do that. But that's how it's being done now, and I don't know whether Joan could lay her hands on a copy of the draft that we forwarded to this committee yesterday, but I'd like to read the section that provides for indigent defense counsel and investigative costs under this very circumstance.
I thank you, and I'm aware, but I don't know if the other committee members need to. I recall what we did.
Let me answer Representative Richards, if I may, at least we try, and then Representative Cohen. Sandy, the language in the first sentence about which you raised a question, I would respond to in this way, which is that as soon as possible means as soon as possible. That is really no different, as far as I construe it, from the language that's in the existing statute, which says report shall be made available as soon as possible after it's completed, but in any case prior to the hearing. If the existing language would make you more comfortable, I'd certainly be happy to substitute it for that that's in Judge Beatty's motion, but I really think the as soon as possible language is the same as existing law.
So I don't lose track of the points, ask a question at this point. How can you effectively prepare a rebuttal to material in that report if you receive it the morning of the hearing with 2 hours left before you go in to rebut it?
Well, the only way you can prepare is to make sure in the law that it has to be delivered to you as soon as possible. Now, the problem that they were talking about is that a commitment hearing may begin with a temporary hold. So you've got the person and you have to bring them to a hearing within 72 hours. So no one's really got a whole lot of time before this thing comes up. But that's in the nature of commitment proceeding itself. I am for the policy of getting the report done quickly, then getting it to the person. Now, I don't know what words to use to make it more clear that it's got to get there presto as soon as it's done.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Walford, I think, has been waiting.
Yeah. Crawling the wall. Now, Sandy, as a matter of fact, I think Lauren touched on this earlier today.
usually when you get these appointments, it's the afternoon before the following morning when you have to go in. And you have to hightail it over to the courthouse and pick up the copy of the investigative report. It's there. You get it. That's the only quick way you're going to get it. And in the practical world, that's the way they happen. So I read the first sentence as simply just saying that it's going to be provided to us just as soon as possible from the date that we're appointed. In answer to Representative Cohen's concern, at least to my knowledge, in our area, attorneys are being appointed to all mental commitment hearings, since there's an indigency, and are being paid. So we don't have an appointed counsel problem. Being appointed, being paid, reports are being made available, although, as I say, for those of us who are not in the same town, we have to drive over to pick up that report and usually go from there to the psychiatric ward to do the investigation and talk with the client. So what I see this essentially initially is doing in the first sentence is nothing more than what is done today. Secondly, then we get into the question of making the copies available to counsel assisting the court, if there is counsel assisting the court, and I have not yet had a case in which there has been counsel, even though we talked about it earlier and earlier in legislation before this committee. I have yet to handle a case in the last couple of years in which there has been participation by the district attorney or any other counsel on the other side. But that would be made available to them. It's kind of like, I guess, what happens today in the criminal law area is that we have a completely open file system in the criminal law area. Defense counsel is entitled to copies of all investigative reports, even though they may not later be introduced in evidence in trial. We have access to all investigative reports, recommendations, and what have you, on our client.
Representative Cohen.
Do these not, are we not proposing, though, that these investigative reports include medical reports?
I think we're talking about two different things.
So,
not
in here?
Not in
no medical reports at all in here?
Not in this provision,
no. That's just the neighbor next door
and the
person who had previous contact with them.
These are the commitment reports, whether they're picked up by officer or whether it's on a two-person hold or whatever. They're, my experience, investigative reports are very short. Not much, not an awful lot to them.
Mr. Chairman, they do include comments of the physician in the investigative reports, but the problem with this provision is not so much the time when you get it, because you're going to get it the afternoon before, and in some cases you do get it the morning of the hearing. That's not unusual, and that'll probably continue on no matter what we do.
Sure.
So my objection is the fact that although it's coming to you, it's going to be coming to you at essentially the same time, the report will be given to the court and will be used by the court to assist in all this good language here, but you just won't have the ability to in any way contradict or controvert that report by the fact it will come to you so late.
Well, I would say that unless you could make a provision in here that says the report has to come to you at least 24 hours or 48 hours prior to the hearing, that it's going to back you up a little bit, because now whereas you get the report late, the impact is kind of minimized by the fact that you can keep it out. And now you can't keep it out, but you're going to have to get the witnesses to controvert it.
Tom, with all due respect, this allows me to answer Sandy's question, because that is not the case. You can't use under this language, you can't use a statement of a witness in that hearing unless the witness is there or the attorney for the other side hasn't objected.
Well,
the point of it is that you can, that the thing's not admissible evidence, you can't use it, and you can't force the state to bring in the people who made that statement if you're going to use a record of an extrajudicial statement that's contained in the report.
This is the interesting anomaly in the law, where the report comes in as made part of the record.
Right.
Since the report itself should be made part of the record, and the judge is supposed to put his blinders on, see, and he's not supposed to consider as evidence those statements that are made that are objected to or where the witnesses are not present. Now, that's supposed to we have other situations like that in law. Whenever you have a court trial and someone blurts out hearsay, you know, you can object to that, and the judge says, yeah, that's fine, I just won't consider that. But there is a question as to really what kind of effect that has upon him being human beings and all.
I just would pose an analogy. That was like telling the jury in Columbia County, after the judge ruled on the choice of evils defense, to ignore all the testimony they heard about nuclear power.
Chairman? I move to amend the amendment by striking the sentence that says the report itself should be made part of the record.
Okay.
Pardon, Mr. Chairman.
There's another big issue here.
Let's wait a second. We've got. You want to amend your motion?
Yeah, let me just place the motion without that offending sentence in it.
Okay. I'm going to place that motion. With Representative Frohmeyer withdraws his earlier motion, now moves to Leach's Line 13, 18, page 3, inserting the following paragraph with the exception of the sentence that reads, the report itself should be made part of the record, period. Representative Mason.
Well, there's still two very objectionable portions of this. First of all, it's made available to the examiners. And secondly, it is made available to the court in the sentence above for use in questioning the witnesses. And as long as it's made available to the court, then it's in.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Smith.
Maybe I'm off base on my analogy, and one of the trial attorneys can correct me, but it seems to me that our typical use of an expert witness in a civil trial includes the right to pose to that person a hypothetical question upon which they can base an opinion.
That's accurate.
I don't see that that's substantially different from giving them, quote, hypothetical hearsay material in a report that when they evaluate it and coupled with their on-site observations, they come to an opinion. Most experts work on that basis. They get a referring report from another doctor. It says, George, I think this guy's loony. Would you check him out? He checks him out. You're right, Eddie, he's loony. It's not that different from the way they operate and the way that society has accepted their operation, including in the court of law.
Representative Rutherford.
The distinction, the difference is that the hypothetical question has to be based upon evidence which has been introduced at the trial. It's not hypothetical in the sense that there's no connection with the trial and there's been no opportunity to test it.
That's true.
Okay. So further discussion of the motion, Representative Longhorn.
Well, let me address this then again to Representative Mason. As long as you don't make the report itself part of the record, but it's basically used as, say, the reports that we obtained from the district attorney to use to cross-examine the police officer when he is put on the stand to testify. What is your objection to making those, I guess the analogy that I didn't really draw an analogy with the examiner, but let's say the examiner has to know why the person is brought in there in the first place. What's the complaint? Was the individual arrested on a DUI because he was found weaving and wobbly? I mean, the analogy is, why was the individual, which, will come out of statements in the investigative report, brought in there or alleged to have been brought in there in the first place? What do you see is harmful in the pursuit of truth in this whole process? To make that investigative report available to the examiners and for use in questioning witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, what I find objectionable is that the examiners, in my view, are to base their opinions or expert opinions, that's what they're there to give, upon what I consider valid evidence which can be subjected to the heat of cross-examination and the right of confrontation, that the examiners base their opinion on watching or interacting or interviewing during the whole hearing process the allegedly mentally ill person, and that allowing in the written report will allow in perhaps unverifiable and unfounded statements and observations upon which the examiner will draw conclusions and give to the court. In other words, I want to see the evidence which is evaluated by the examiner to be...
Let me give you a hypothetical then, Tom. So I have a case like this. Little old lady, sweet little old lady, Her only problem is she likes to go stand out on her doorstep, she's 79 years old, without any clothes on. Now, the investigative report, reports this behavior. If you're going to take the investigative report out, okay, you're just simply going to set up a sterile situation here where my little old lady is dressed in white hospital dress, and the investigator, the examiner goes in there and he's given a charge to look at her. Tell me if something's wrong with her. If the doctor, if the examiner doesn't have the ability to garner a behavioral history leading up to that date of examination, and granted, the representations in the investigative report may be hearsay, but they are hearsay just to the same extent that medical history related to a physician is hearsay. It's a basis upon which he develops an opinion and does a diagnosis and then prescribes treatment. And if you've got a situation here where you have an investigation report that in fact relates, albeit via hearsay, but relates behavioral characteristics that are the very reason for the person being there, I think it's silly to keep that out.
Well, may I reply?
I have a question.
Wait just a second. I have four until I recognize somebody else. It seems to me that, we're fighting the problem of are we really looking at this hearing in the light of trying to help someone, or whether it's an adversary process, and I think I've come to the conclusion it's a little bit of both, no matter what we do. And it seems to me that hearsay, probably in some cases, is relevant. And the best that we can do is to provide for some adequate safeguards to allow proper cross-examination to test the validity of the hearsay that's there. I think, fine, let the investigative report come in. Okay, but provide at least enough time and at least ability for the defense counsel to either produce the witnesses or to produce evidence to controvert the hearsay that's in the report. And I think that's where our thrust should be on the thing.
I think you have that in the provisions of the bill that allow for a set over, first of all, the 72-hour set over. Secondly, for the even possibly additional 14 days.
Further discussion, Representative Mason?
Well, a very brief rebuttal to Representative Lombard's situation. That exact situation, the essence of whether or not the person is mentally ill may go to whether or not it was indeed her that was standing out on the porch in a metropolitan area. There might be some question. And the reliability of the witness, who may, for some reason, have disliked this and they trumped up this story. And it's one way where the information comes in, showing some very bizarre and perhaps mentally ill behavior. But it's not bizarre or mentally ill behavior if it isn't indeed the allegedly mentally ill person, and there would be no way to test the credibility of the person making the statement. That's what the purpose of cross-examination is for.
Of course, if you had enough time between the time the report comes in,
you have enough time.
If we required the report to be provided, say 24 hours prior to the time of the hearing,
that's better.
I'll amend my motion. I'll withdraw my old motion and put that amendment in.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a second. We've got motions flying here about... Okay, Representative Frommeyer withdraws his motion. And before I place that motion, I'm going to recognize Representative
Richards. Mr. Chairman, where do we specifically define what shall be contained in the investigative report? If it's evident... In the draft, I've missed it. I can't find it. What shall be contained in the investigative report? What kind of evidence are we giving to everybody?
It's in there. On page 2 of the bill that we're working with, subsection 2.
Yeah. And I guess I read past the rest where I did.
It says, include an interview or examination of the allegedly mentally ill person in his home or other place familiar to the individual. Include an interview with the individual's relatives, neighbors, and physician.
Page 2, 7.
Page 2, line 33 through about 37.
23.
I'm going to place it right now. Representative Frommeyer moves that we, are you leaving the record out about the court, make the court, the report itself should be part of the record?
That's out. That's out.
Okay, Representative Frommeyer moves that line 13 to 18 in page 3 of the bill be deleted, the next paragraph be inserted, which is on the Judicial Conference Memorandum, page 3, dated April 6, 79, with the exception that the sentence, the report itself should be made part of the record, is deleted, with a further amendment to that, that the report, a copy of the investigative report, shall be provided to the allegedly mentally ill person into that person's counsel at least 24 hours prior to the hearing.
Well, I would leave the modifier as soon as possible in, Mr. Chairman.
But in no case.
In no event
okay.
Later than 24.
As soon as possible, but in no case less than 24 hours prior to the hearing. Is there discussion? Is there objection? The hearing then is stopped. Okay. What's the next one?
There's another page in there.
On the medical records, I thought Donna was going to provide a proposed amendment. I haven't seen one. Sandy had a problem.
Can they amend those hands? Mr. Chairman?
Representative Frommeyer.
I believe that, again, the artful compromise that the good judge satisfies Representative Zajon. Representative Frommeyer satisfies the committee, so I'll move it to see if it does.
Well, the committee didn't have any problem with the medical records except that Sandy wanted to make sure that comments of psychiatric aids and things like that weren't included. She wanted only doctors. There is a problem that wasn't brought up last time. The medical record is being made available to the examiners only, apparently, and not to the to the allegedly mentally ill person's counsel. I don't know whether that's an issue I meant to bring up and forgot to. I don't know whether anybody's interested in that.
Okay, that appears where? On page 4?
On page 5.
Page 5?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Okay.
But I guess Donna didn't come up with an amendment. I don't know whether.
Okay, so basically there are two policy decisions to determine in this area. One is whether or not the other comments other than doctors should be in the medical records that are presented to the court, and whether or not a copy of the medical record should be provided to the mentally ill person, allegedly mentally ill person, and his counsel. Okay, the chair would move that a copy of the medical reports be provided, again, 24 hours prior to the hearing, to the allegedly mentally ill person and his counsel. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Tim Frommeyer.
I would rather see you limit your amendment to have them provided to counsel. The reason that, having dealt tangentially with a couple of these problems in the past, there are times when the medical records will say this person is decompensating and is suicidal, and I believe the threats are real. If you give that record to the person might jump over the bridge. And I think there is a case where counsel might use some discretion in what's shared with the client. I think it's a little safer to do it that way.
We have the same problem with the investigative report, because the language in that section relates to the mentally ill person also.
Well, that doesn't relate to what the doctor has said about the person, though.
No, it relates to what his friends have said.
Well, that may be.
That could be worse.
But it is current law that it's required to be given to the person. Nobody indicated there'd been problems with that, but maybe.
Well, I had a report once from a person going into a sentencing hearing, which told me not to give this, he was giving this report to share with the judge and keep my file, but not to show my client. And I believed him. That caused my client to jump over the edge.
Okay, I would withdraw that portion of my motion that relates to providing a medical record to the allegedly mentally ill person, require that only be provided to his counsel. Is there a discussion? Is there a chicken? Person Richards?
Mr. Cameron, there are the last two lines of that underlined material on page 5 that I find a special concern, that is relating to a specific detention period prior to the hearing. I'm concerned that the detention itself may aggravate or otherwise distort the mental state of the person that we're talking about, and that if that treatment record for that detention period is not given its proper weight and perspective, that there may be a finding made that doesn't reflect the reason for which the proceedings were commenced in the first place. Do you understand what I'm saying? If a person's suffering from exaggerated depression consistently, but detention aggravates that mental state.
I think Donna.
Representative from where?
I'm sorry. Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I think that testimony was that is typically taken into account by the observing professional. Donna, who's been on hundreds of these cases, says that that's not a problem. I mean, there's no testimony that we've had, Sandy, that would seems to me give credence to your concern.
Well, Representative Fulmer, I guess, you know, it's right here.
No, I would generally right have the same concern, but I, you know, there's no evidence that substantiates that for me, so I guess I'd conclude that everyone knows that a period of detention is a period of stress, and that nonetheless that a mental health professional is capable of evaluating that stress is one factor in reaching a conclusion is the person's total ability to cope with the world.
Mental health person, I agree. How about the court?
Court's making findings on the basis of what the experts tell the court. The court isn't a psychiatrist.
Further discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the motion?
Yeah.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Smith? Representative
Rutherford?
Aye.
Richard?
No.
Mason?
Mr. Chairman, this is the new language about the copy of the...
No, it's not. Just a second. This is my motion. Let's hold the roll. I'm going to restate the motion. The motion is to require that the hospital... It's this language, but requiring that the hospital record relating to the specific detention period be provided to the allegedly mentally ill's counsel 24 hours prior to the hearing. That's the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
24 hours. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith just walked in.
I didn't hear the motion placed.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
The motion is the language that is on page 5 of the draft, which relates to page 4 of the bill, lines 3-5, with a conceptual amendment that says that the hospital record relating to the specific period of detention be provided to the allegedly mentally ill person's counsel at least 24 hours prior to the hearing. There was objection to that amendment. We are now about to call
the objection.
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, I may have misunderstood. My objection is to the language in 25 and 26, line 25 and 26.
Well, that's included in the motion.
So that's where my objection arises.
Okay, that's fine.
Can we split the motion?
Well, we can vote on this motion, and then if there's another motion relating that language, I'll be glad to place.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Rutherford? Aye. Richards? No. Mason? Aye. Lombard?
Aye.
Cronemeyer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Buick?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye. Passes.
Is
there further
motions
regarding that section?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mason?
I like your copy of the report going to council, but I still find this whole section objectionable. So that's why I voted for the motion to add that language. However, given my better with your language than without, that I will move that the whole new language provision be struck so we can vote on it as a whole now that your language has been added.
Okay, Representative Mason moves that the language on page 5 of the draft lines 21 through 26 with the conceptual motion that it be provided to the Ledgewood Memorial Christmas Camp for 24 hours private hearing is stricken from consideration. I guess that also would include on page 4 of the printed bill striking that provision. Okay, is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bugis? No.
Cohen?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Smith?
No.
Gardner?
No. Fails.
Okay. What's the next issue we have to do?
The next issue is the standard of proof.
Did we have a deadlock vote on that?
Yes.
Chairman?
Representative Cronemeyer.
I move current convention.
Approved the clear and convincing evidence. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll. Okay.
Chairman, there's one more issue, and that's whether the bill should go to Ways and Means or not.
I'm sure that'll be a 5-4 vote, too.
Well, the impact statement that we got has a $1.6 million fiscal impact for the new definition of mentally ill.
Can there be 9 minority reports on something like this?
No. If there were 9 minority reports, it wouldn't pass. I was given something as the work session was started which reduces the fiscal impact significantly, but the people from the Mental Health Division apparently can't tell me why they've changed their estimates. So,
what are they now asking?
Looks to me as though the total county now would be $336,200 and total state $112,200.
Is there something to refer on the
Mr. Chairman,
I'm opposed to the bill, but I'm not going to set it away from you because I...
Just still on the floor, so
yeah. No, I've been through these things. I don't think that there will be some more people committed. I think there will be minimal, perhaps in needy cases, and perhaps in cases that I would, in my view, it would not think deserve committee, but I don't think this bill will have that much fiscal impact, and I would not only oppose the bill, but further, I'm not going to vote to send it to Ways and Means if anybody wants to try that one. I don't like that. I said that on the floor today, and I'm not going to do it here.
Okay. Okay.
Chair.
Representative Cohen.
We still haven't addressed, and the committee members can say it should not make any difference to me in light of my past votes, but we have not addressed some of the costs of the local governments in terms of this. What I see is we've opened it up to extra legalistic investigations and witnesses and cross-examination, and we're going to have extra fees there, and it's going to fall on the local government area. I just want to make sure we don't drop something on those people who are charged with doing that. Just drop it on them. I think we ought to look at it and get at least send it out to say, can you give us a fix on what do you think the impact, and I'm not speaking to the mental health division, I'm talking about the other end of it that we've been through in our subcommittee.
I just want to clear up one thing that you said, Joyce, and I don't, it's not all of what you said. I think that the area where we're going to go to cost on investigation and lawyers and so forth is not in this bill, because I don't believe this changes the current law with regard to the proceeding and how it will be conducted. Maybe the number of proceedings will be increased. The bill that we worked on yesterday on the investigative costs and attorney's fees would have that effect. But that's the fiscal impact on that bill, not this one.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one more response to that. Then I'm not clear what we've done in the sense of we've said we've opened up these records to a broader view, including more people to look at them. Number one. Number two, in order to do that, we have instituted some insurance to make sure, to the best of the council's ability in defense, that they have an opportunity to really go after and develop a defense based on the records that we've now opened up to a broader scrutiny. And I disagree with you a little bit in terms of what it's really going to mean. And we've also given them some more time to do that. Now, there are some of these areas that I support in this bill, but this is one I just want to lay out to make the record clear that we have and somebody has raised that issue when we consider this bill.
Person Zayshon, you want to come up and make some kind of a comment?
Yes, John Zayshon.
Identify yourself for the record.
John Zayshon, District 32. My experience with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I think all of you, is that they're quick to get on bills that have fiscal impact. And I've spoken with them since summer about some of these changes. And they don't believe that there is a big fiscal impact, or I think you would see them here. That was my response.
I'd like to. Are there further motions on the bill?
Sure.
Representative Romer.
Well, if we move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, that will precipitate a fiscal report, which then would allow us, collectively or individually, to decide further what the bill ought to go to waste means.
We do have a fiscal impact statement. I don't
think that in light of the changes that have been made since then, though, that's one that I would want to rely on, whether I oppose the bill or favor it.
I would feel, I personally am willing to vote for the bill in the form that it's presently in. But I would like to see, I do have a question in my mind whether or not it should go to Ways and Means at this point. I'm not clear.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards.
How about a 10-day review?
They wouldn't do it, I bet.
Do you think they would?
What, Ways and Means?
Mm-hmm. That would precipitate a fiscal impact statement before action by our committee on the floor.
I just don't think that they, we can ask them to take a look at. They got a lot of other things to do, though.
I just run around with those Ways and Means, eagle eyes, catches on the floor, and then our feelings won't be hurt if they really feel they ought to have it.
Yeah.
Well,
excuse me.
In response to that, John Zayshon, District 32, they're not planning to get into the mental health budget for a while yet. And I think, you know, any Ways and Means person would want to do it in context. So I really do not think that a 10-day review would be a viable way.
Yeah. Well, we could also request, I suppose, that if anyone had that concern, that they go to the Ways and Means on the Senate side.
Yes.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. First one is, by putting the time periods that the reports have to be in prior to the hearing,
have we somehow screwed up the timing sequence of the hearing and the detention period and all the different periods? That's one question.
Well, there's a possible problem with 24 hours for the medical report, because the person presumably will be held. Right now you can hold him for 3 days plus 72 hours. If it's just 3 days, what you'll get is the first 2 days of the medical report, which may be enough, I don't know. The rest of it, I don't think that it's messing it up.
Okay. Second thing is, is it possible for us to ask legislative fiscal for an impact on the bill as it's amended?
I will.
Okay.
If you're going to do that, I would appreciate it if you didn't vote the bill out yet, because if you voted out, it has to be down to the clerk's office in 3 days.
Okay. I have no intention of killing the bill. I would be more than happy to schedule it sometime. How soon can we get that report?
Well, I'll talk to the person today and see if he can get on.
Okay. This bill will be scheduled for work session and hopefully for a final vote, either to wait to meet to the floor, probably by about the middle of next week, first appropriate work session happens. Okay?
So the work session on 2438. This is the time of the Sheriff's Commission that we would adjourn unless someone has some dying matter that they want to have the committee act upon this afternoon.
Well, 10 after 3 in a Friday afternoon or 2 minutes after.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do this stop bill just to get it out of the air, be very frank.
We've got one bill. It's a simple one. Representative Mason expressed some desire to take a vote on. Matt's, what's the House bill number?
2176. This one was kept over because you were.
Yeah, this bill's the stop and frisk bill, 2176.
2176 seems to have to do with bad checks.
2764. Okay. Is there a motion on House Bill 2764?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, it failed to go to the floor last time on a 3-4 vote.
Four in favor?
Three in favor.
Three in favor.
Well, we held this because you were the chief sponsor. We wanted you to have your chance to...
Okay, well, in that case...
Fire your cannon.
Didn't want to shoot your dog without you being present.
The chair would move that House Bill 2764 be sent before the due pass recommendations or discussion.
Which bill?
Clerk will call the roll.
Which bill?
This is that militaristic stop and search bill.
Owen?
No.
Grommar?
Would you pass on that one, please?
Okay. Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Richards?
No.
Rutherford?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Somewhere?
No.
Gardner?
Aye. Fails. Chair would move that House Bill 2764 be tabled. The motion's non-debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Grommar?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Ugas?
Aye.
Aye. Passes. Okay. We're adjourned.